Y2K led to this mad rush for Indian brain power to get the programming work done. The Indian companies were good and cheap, but price wasn't first on customers' minds. Getting the work done was, and India was the only place with the volume of workers to do it. Then the dot-com boom comes along right in the wake of Y2K, and India is one of the few places where you can find surplus English-speaking engineers at any price, because all of those in America have been scooped up by e-commerce companies. Then the dot-com bubble bursts, the stock market tanks, and the pool of investment capital dries up. American IT companies that survived the boom and venture capital firms that still wanted to fund startups had much less cash to spend. Now they needed those Indian engineers not just because there were a lot of them, but precisely because they were low cost. So the relationship between India and the American business community intensified another notch. August 15th commemorates Freedom at Midnight. Y2K made possible employment at midnight, but not any employment. Employment for India's best knowledge workers. August 15th gave independence to India, but Y2K gave independence to Indians. Not all, by any stretch of the imagination, but a lot more than 50 years ago, and many of them from the most productive segment of the population. In that sense, yes, India was lucky, but it also reaped what it had sowed through hard work and education and the wisdom of its elders who built all those IITs. Louis Pasteur said it a long time ago, "Fortune favors the prepared mind." Flattener number 6, offshoring. Running with gazelles, eating with lions. On December 11, 2001, China formally joined the World Trade Organization, which meant Beijing agreed to follow the same global rules governing imports, exports, and foreign investments that most countries in the world were following. It meant China was agreeing, in principle, to make its own competitive playing field as level as the rest of the world. A few days later, the American-trained Chinese manager of a fuel pump factory in Beijing, which was owned by a friend of mine, Jack Perkowski, the chairman and CEO of Asimco Technologies, an American auto parts manufacturer in China, posted the following African proverb, translated into Mandarin, on his factory floor. "Every morning in Africa, a gazelle wakes up. It knows it must run faster than the fastest lion, or it will be killed. Every morning, a lion wakes up. It knows it must outrun the slowest gazelle, or it will starve to death. It doesn't matter whether you are a lion or a gazelle. When the sun comes up, you better start running." I don't know who is the lion and who is the gazelle, but I do know this. Ever since the Chinese joined the WTO, both they and the rest of the world have had to run faster and faster. This is because China's joining the WTO gave a huge boost to another form of collaboration, offshoring. Offshoring, which has been around for decades, is different from outsourcing. Offshoring, by contrast, is when a company takes one of its factories that is operating in Canton, Ohio, and moves the whole factory offshore to Canton, China. There, it produces the very same product in the very same way, only with cheaper labor, lower taxes, subsidized energy, and lower healthcare costs. By joining the World Trade Organization in 2001, China assured foreign companies that if they shifted factories offshore to China, they would be protected by international law and standard business practices. This greatly enhanced China's attractiveness as a manufacturing platform. Under WTO rules, Beijing agreed, with some time for phase-in, to treat non-Chinese citizens or firms as if they were Chinese in terms of their economic rights and obligations under Chinese law. This meant that foreign companies could sell virtually anything anywhere in China. WTO membership status also meant that Beijing agreed to treat all WTO member nations equally, meaning that the same tariffs and the same regulations had to apply equally for everyone. And it agreed to submit itself to international arbitration in the event of a trade dispute with another country or a foreign company. At the same time, government bureaucrats became more customer-friendly, Procedures for investments were streamlined, and websites proliferated in different ministries to help foreigners navigate China's business regulations. Because China can amass so many low-wage workers at the unskilled, semi-skilled, and skilled levels because it has such a voracious appetite for factory, equipment, and knowledge jobs to keep its people employed, and because it has such a massive and burgeoning consumer market, it has become an unparalleled zone for offshoring. China has more than 160 cities with a population of 1 million or more. You can go to towns on the east coast of China today that you have never heard of and discover that this one town manufactures most of the eyeglass frames in the world, while the town next door manufactures most of the portable cigarette lighters in the world. And the one next to that is doing most of the computer screens for Dell, and another is specializing in mobile phones. The more attractive China makes itself as a base for offshoring, the more attractive other developed and developing countries competing with it, like Malaysia, Thailand, Ireland, Mexico, Brazil, and Vietnam, have to make themselves. This has created a process of competitive flattening, in which countries scramble to see who can give companies the best tax breaks, education incentives, and subsidies on top of their cheap labor to encourage offshoring to their shores. China's real long-term strategy is to outrace America and the EU countries to the top, and the Chinese are off to a good start. China's leaders are much more focused than many of their Western counterparts on how to train their young people in the math, science, and computer skills required for success in the flat world, how to build a physical and telecom infrastructure that will allow Chinese people to plug and play faster and easier than others, and how to create incentives that will attract global investors. What China's leaders really want is the next generation of underwear or airplane wings to be designed in China as well. That is where things are heading in another decade. So in 30 years, we will have gone from sold in China to made in China to designed in China to dreamed up in China, or from China as collaborator with the worldwide manufacturers on nothing to China as a low-cost, high-quality, hyper-efficient collaborator with worldwide manufacturers on everything. This should allow China to maintain its role as a major flattening force, provided that political instability does not disrupt the process.